Welcome to another special edition of the Washington AI Network podcast, recorded at Seed AI House at South by Southwest. I'm Tammy Haddad, and today you'll hear from four incredible innovators I met in Austin, each harnessing open source AI to make real impact. We'll start with Andrea Papancia, CEO of NLX, who's turning AI-powered conversations into practical business solutions. Then you'll hear from Dr. Cal Clark, a radiologist at the University of Texas, San Antonio, and the founder of Xuron Labs. He is using AI to eliminate mistakes in medical imaging. Next, Martha Scylla Underwood, founder and CEO of Prism. We'll discuss how she's helping people protect vital financial documents with AI-enabled digital vaults. And finally, I'll speak with Bosco Cante of Highwave, a Grammy Award-winning engineer merging music, math, and open source AI to empower a new era of artistic expression. Let's jump right in with Andrea Papancia. I'm Tammy Haddad here at South by Southwest with the CEO and Chief Product Officer too, right? At NLX, spoke earlier today. What did you talk about?
I talked about how you can scale corporate partnerships, like how can tiny companies end up partnering with giants?
That's the big question, right? Not just here at South by Southwest, but overall. But let's step back and let's talk about NLX, make sure our audience know what you guys do in AI.
Yes, indeed. Well, it's probably worth mentioning that I was born and raised in Romania, and I've been building technology ever since I was in fifth grade.
Fifth grade? That's embarrassing. I couldn't do it now.
Well, there was a lot of learning by doing, but someone was paying me to learn. So I was like, this sounds like a good gig. And in the process, I just gained a lot of breadth and then depth in specific areas. And then fast forward to 2015 and 2016, where I started working for American Express. I built their, what you'd refer to as the conversational AI platform, their AI assistant that powered the main servicing channel. The system I built was the first line of defense between the customer and the brand.
So do people call that a chatbot now?
They would, although now I think the new buzzword is AI agents.
Oh, we're going to get to all that. I have a lot of questions about that. Wasn't American Express really one of the first to have that kind of conversation in a serious way, as opposed to we're going to pretend like we're talking to you because we don't really want to talk to you at all?
They were quite early. And one interesting attribute about Amex is that they have a very loyal customer base. And as a result, they're very resilient to being experimented on, right? So if the company released new projects, new things, card members quickly jumped on and they subscribed or, you know, they joined test groups, etc. And yeah, it ended up being a super impactful project. And as a result, after doing some consulting for some large brands and some smaller ones, I just saw the need on how companies might want to leverage these new technologies. But then nobody was really doing it through the lens of how I experienced at American Express, which is when I decided to co-found NLX with my brother and one of my high school friends, also from Romania. Mm-hmm. He's a little bit of a prodigy, Olympic gold medalist internationally in physics, out of all things.
Incredible. So you saw this AI coming around the bend before most.
Very much so. And the interesting thing while I was at Amex is I had to evaluate a lot of AI language providers available in the market. And one of my biggest learnings from the whole experience is that the AI is not the main driver of automation. And that still is true to this day.
What is?
Content. Simply put, the AI can understand even with like very high accuracy, you're trying, let's say, to file a dispute or change your flight or what have you. If you don't have conversational content to engage in that sort of back and forth between the human and the AI assistant, you'll have to send that conversation to an agent anyways. So as a result, we've made a choice at NLX. We effectively work with very large brands to just help them automate things through conversation. But we made the choice to not focus on building the actual AI models. Instead, we integrate off the shelf what's on the market or what the customer's preferences are. And that allows us to bring the problem closer to the customer so they can just focus on their applications and logic and whatever they're trying to do. And then we do away with the complexity of what it takes to stitch together all these technologies, which is part of what I had to do at Amex.
And what are businesses telling you? I mean, is this an effective way for them to communicate with their customers or acquire new customers?
It's incredibly effective if done right. Think in today's market, there's a lot of smoke and mirrors on what AI can and cannot do and will solve all the world's problems and stuff. It doesn't quite work that way. Ultimately, let's say if you're thinking about the statistic in the market where 90% of the projects fail, 100% of our projects go to production because we take a very practical approach to how you build the applications. Sometimes you don't need AI to solve certain problems, right? So ultimately, we work with our customers backwards from their ideal solution. Let's say if someone calls up an insurance company and you can tell by looking up their phone number into a system that, hey, there's an open claim, that might be why they're calling about. So you could probably say, hey, Tammy, are you calling about your open claim? And then you'll be like, yes, versus hello, thank you for calling XYZ company. Our menu options have changed. That doesn't build trust to the user. And as a result, then the end user experience ends up being sloppy and people then press zero and then it's not impactful.
That's what I do. I do that every time. Who doesn't do that? And how much investment is there by a company? I mean, do you have a box of tools? Because you're dealing with business. You're not dealing with private people.
Correct.
Right?
We provide them a platform. And the platform, to maybe put it through a different lens, we're giving people the Lego blocks. We bring all this cutting edge technology to almost like a play level. And then just like with Legos, the difference between, let's say, a crappy toy or a really beautiful toy is creativity. So we simplify, we introduce abstractions and we simplify how you can leverage these technologies to the point where you can just very easily work backwards from what you're building. There's a no-code graphical user interface where you can just kind of click around and design how you want the AI interaction to work, which is then super useful for non-technical business stakeholders too, because they understand their business process and they can make the changes themselves as opposed to send this to a PM who sends it to a designer, then sends it to engineering. And then by the time it comes back, it's like the cordless telephone. Like what you want that doesn't really match the end result.
So ChatGPT comes out. Were you surprised by that?
I guess I got the slight hint of what was coming maybe 2-3 months in advance, largely because a particular investor included us into a market map about generative AI. And at the time, I remember, I was like, what do you mean generative AI? You know, that wasn't a term that was just thrown around. And then after doing some research, sort of started to see the inflection point of how ChatGPT was catching quite a bit of ground. And then, yeah, we certainly got faced with questions from investors and otherwise, is this going to just eliminate your business?
Right.
The reality is, going back to the origins, we engineered the product to be independent of whatever the AI capabilities were, because the main driver of automation is, once again, content, right? So what ChatGPT did for our business is accelerate. It had a very natural place. Imagine if you just put that in front of your customers.
They have no idea.
No, but more importantly, because it's appealing, right? It's very quick. You just interact with it and it's so natural and human. But if you put that in front of your customers with no other capabilities or engineering work around it, that in this case, and let's say an NLX provides, it's just like hiring a customer support agent and then starting to route calls or chats to them and telling them, you're going to service the customers, but I'm not going to give you access to the customer care portal where, you know, you can look up their information and do stuff on their behalf, right? It doesn't solve problems standalone. It's a phenomenal consumer product and you can do amazing things on the business side too, but you have to build more things than just use it out of the box.
Okay, so we have to talk about AI agents because that is what everyone's talking about.
Yes.
And to be clear, because nothing is totally defined, my point of view of that is that you will be able to go to an agent and they'll, you know, set up your whole trip to Italy and pay for your tickets and get your kids the right passes and all that sort of stuff. You have been quite strong on pointing out that is really not going to happen, maybe in the next couple of years, at least.
Technologically, self-reasoning computer system that can then take actions on your behalf independently.
Right.
It's feasible to build those systems, but not in the holistic way that they're being positioned in the market. And the main reason for that is if we take a step back from the AI portion and think about the world around us, the world runs on determinism on all kinds of deterministic processes, whether it's, you know, how airlines work or banks. There's always some sort of process that's highly deterministic. If this happens, you go here, you go to there. So in order to make these AI agents or AI-powered anything useful, you have to enable them to access and execute deterministic workflows. So a pure AI system that somehow just magically gets access to a database, the non-technical groups, like you'll hear this type of buzz talk in Silicon Valley and all of these different echo chambers, the world just doesn't work that way. Technology just doesn't work that way. But oftentimes the barrier of enabling these types of interactions breaks down to inaccessible business processes. A simple example, let's say you're an airline and you say, hey, I want to have an AI agent that, you know, can add pets to a flight and change flights and does this and does that. Okay. Do you have a programmatic interface? They're called APIs that allows you to add a pet to a flight, as an example. No. Okay. Then the AI agent, quote unquote, is not going to be able to do it either, right? So there's no magic. At the same time, there's like phenomenal things you can do with the large language models and AI in general, but they only take you so far.
Yeah, I never could figure out how that would work, because why would I want to give AI my credit card information and the ability to do all these various things and you're not there? You know, on the military side, and I think in some other sides, there's always talk about keeping human in the loop. But when you talk about agents, the whole idea is there is no human in the loop, which doesn't seem realistic to me at all. So I was really interested in your view of that.
Science of it is such that all AI systems are rooted in statistics. That's just scientific. It's a fact. And statistics are imperfect. Therefore, the output of AI systems is guaranteed to be imperfect. And depending on the problem scope that you're applying these systems to, that imperfection might be reasonable. As an example, when you do a Google search, in the off chance that you get the wrong results, what will you do? I'm just going to rephrase my question and then you get the new results. That tolerance for imperfection is not the same for a driverless car. It's also not the same for, let's say, canceling a flight for an airline or changing the address on file for a bank, because there's real world implications to doing that if you do it incorrectly. And there are very practical ways to sort of blend these, let's say, agentic technologies with deterministic processes. And I'll use a very simple example. Let's use your example with, let's call it the travel concierge. That in itself is a very complex problem. But if you break it down into smaller problems, and I'll break it down into two for the purposes of this example. On one side, you have the very hard problem of capturing, let's say, specific inputs from the end user in an unscripted fashion.
Right. Right.
The way your eye might go to a travel concierge to request something is likely to be very different. And even very different if you're booking a trip for personal travel versus business. For business, I'll be like, hey, I need to be in Dallas from tomorrow till Tuesday. I need to return by 4 p.m. on Tuesday. And, you know, I fly Delta, go book. Right. And then comes back with the results. Great. We're done. Or, I want to go on a surfing trip with my friends in June. Well, where do you want to go? I don't know. What would you suggest? Where's good to surf during that time, right? So you can see how it's very complicated, because traditionally building these types of systems, you'd have to scope out every single permutation of how to ask that question. It's an impossible task. AI and large language models in particular, phenomenal at addressing that problem. We actually have some technology, we call it generative journey, that allows you to do exactly that. You just give the AI the task of be like, hey, I need to collect a, let's say, origin and destination, number of passengers, and the dates. And then come back to me once you have them. And once you have them, then the second part of the problem is, okay, go look up stuff in a system, present them to the user, book.
Right.
Well, AI applied to that is a terrible idea, because it's a deterministic workflow.
Yeah, you're not going to get anywhere.
Yeah, but it's also like, why would you even do that? That's a straightforward problem to solve, because it's being solved already, right? So the holistic application of AI to everything and just hoping it will work isn't practical. And customers, we kind of teach them, it's like, forget what you know about AI and the rest of the stuff. What is the real problem? Work backwards from that, and then we'll figure out where AI makes sense to apply, because ultimately, if it's solving the problem, who cares what's behind it?
And what are you hearing from business leaders? What do they most want? You know, those thrilled by AI and the opportunities. Is it, I want to get rid of as many of my staff people as possible? Is it automation for saving money? Obviously, problem solving. Is there any category that you keep hearing from your clients?
ROI, efficiency. I wouldn't say the headcount cutting comes up often, largely because they're all looking to grow, right? Like any decent business, especially if they're very large, they're looking to grow. And they're more interested in how can I do more with what I have versus like how do I chop people and like kind of scale down in that regard. So ROI is the name of the game. And that's what hasn't really been happening in the market more broadly, because there's a lot of investment, but it's investment in a way like shooting arrows in the dark, because there's a lot of just buzz and snake oil being put out. Like imagine building rockets, shooting arrows in the dark, and you're like, oh, well, let's see if it goes up and comes down. That doesn't work that way. You have to understand the laws of physics and, you know, material science and all these different things, and the accumulation of understanding of what you're trying to address. Yeah, sure, you can innovate, but you need to have an understanding of the world before you can innovate.
You're also teaching at Columbia.
And NYU.
And NYU. How do you talk to students? I mean, obviously, these are very bright students, about AI. The one thing I worry about is the haves and the have-nots, that people don't see it as something that's going to help me with my problems. It's going to only help the wealthy or the connected.
I teach them on how to build systems, computer systems, that leverage AI, that scale. So they can innovate and make this type of technology, and technology that's powered by a standalone, you don't want just the AI, they're applications that you build with AI, and make them accessible at effectively global scale. And I do that by peeling back the layers and giving them assignments and immersing them in real world examples of why things are a certain way, not in another. And it's really cool to be challenged by smart people, and you know, they'll poke holes and be like, well, what about this? And you almost see the light come up on their face the moment you sort of unpack some of these concepts that otherwise in the market, they're just positioned a certain way because it's convenient and it might make some people money.
Right.
But it's not really how it works. So no, I'm not afraid that AI is just going to take over the world and we'll get Terminator and stuff, largely because these are not sentient systems. Computers are actually pretty dumb, and might be an unpopular statement to make, but it's a phenomenal invention. They're really good at executing mathematical operations very fast, much faster than humans ever could. And over time, we've built abstractions over them that create the perception of intelligence, but there's no sentience there.
What about quantum? Because now we've been talking about superintelligence in Washington. Is that something that you're looking at? Are you doing any work in quantum?
We're not directly looking at it, but familiar with the topic. I've read about some of the very recent, I think in the last like week or two, innovations that I think Google announced something and so did Microsoft. And I think Amazon too, but different degrees of, I guess, work or innovations in the space. Because I think one of them releases something and they all work on it and then they feel compelled to like
release. Well, that's the other thing. You're all the folk, which I think is really fascinating and exciting, that all the AI people are pretty much working together, not just the big companies, but all kinds of companies. Do you think that helps advance AI?
Yes. And the reasons for it, once kind of implementing and scaling those chips and the software that can operate on top of them, once that becomes general availability and just general purpose engineer can leverage them to create AI systems on top of, absolutely. Because if anyone takes away anything about quantum computing, is that it can significantly accelerate the number of computations you can do. Right. Something that would have taken 10 years, you could do it maybe in 30 minutes, as an example.
So is superintelligence and quantum, do you think they're the same thing?
I don't think they're the same thing, but one can enable the other, right? So quantum computing can enable superintelligence, largely because artificial intelligence is very computationally intensive. Right? So if you can make very expensive computations, expensive in terms of time and obviously resources too, if you can make them a lot faster and cheaper, well,
There you go.
You can keep innovating and accelerate things even further.
What about DeepSeek? Were you surprised? And do you believe that they weren't using as much computational power?
I've actually talked to like a wide array of people on this, including some that know some of the people close to DeepSeek.
So, interesting.
Even prior to that, my take on it was Silicon Valley just put sour grapes face to the world. It's like, too bad. It doesn't matter what they use. They published their work. They open sourced it. And they bypassed some of the biases and limitations of NVIDIA chips and some of, like CUDA. But basically, they got creative and circumvented some of the traditional ways of training these models. And yes, they had some access to some phenomenal engineers. I hear that they managed to tap into like cream of the crop people because they just had a lot of money to just recruit them. So forget the computational power and chips right. and stuff. They recruited super smart people. And the fact that they ended up open sourcing their work and publishing, and I have quite a few PhD friends, and they're like, this is such a cool paper. It's so well done and whatnot. Well, good for them.
That's what Sam Altman said, by the way. He said good for them, too.
I did hear at the same time, Sam Altman also like threw a bunch of fingers. They're like, oh, they like got more chips and it's under embargo and this and that. There was a little bit of, again, the sour grapes is what I would define that overall. But I think no matter where the competition comes from, it should now push us in the US, harder and innovate. Because I think history teaches us when you coast, you lose.
All right. Final question. What are you most excited about in the AI field coming up?
I'm very excited about the evolution and I guess more, let's say, generalization of multimodal technology, AI technology, which the way I would define it is leveraging multiple channels in synchronization to drive a richer end user experience. So instead of you're just talking to a voice assistant or to some chatbot, what if the voice assistant could make use of your phone while you're talking to it?
And this is kind of what Meta is working on, right?
Meta's working on it. We actually have this in production as we speak with Fortune 100 companies. United Airlines is one of our customers as an example. They're using this very successfully. They've won awards for these experiences because they can drive the synergy of human senses together, right? When you hear information, you see it and you touch it and whatnot, you assimilate it better. That's just science. Most industry runs on what I would call deflection metrics. It's all, well, we prevented 30% of people from ever speaking to someone. The problem with that approach is that doesn't really touch on how effective was that deflection. Were people happy? Did you actually solve their problems? With the multimodal technology that I'm talking about, we call it Voice Plus for ourselves, it allows you to drive very high automation, but also incredibly high customer satisfaction. We're talking like 90%, which is above what humans typically get.
Right.
Right. So these technologies having evolved to a point where they now can break away from just like that single channel experience and make use of the full computational power of the devices that you have. I mean, we all have phones in our pockets, right? They can do so much stuff. So being able to make better use of the devices that we have on hand drives phenomenal opportunity for just better and better, what I would call it, human-computer interaction. Because ultimately, that's what it boils down to.
I look forward to that. Can I just say, Andre, thank you for painting that great picture of the future and also explaining everything you are doing at NLX. And I hope to see you again soon.
Looking forward to it. Thank you, Tammy.
Now we pivot to the fascinating world of medical imaging with Dr. Cal Clark of Zuron Labs. He's applying AI to catch radiology errors and keep patient care on track. I'm so glad to have Dr. Cal Clark here. He's at Zuron Labs, the University of Texas Health Science Center, San Antonio. So tell us about Zuron Labs and your use of AI.
Yeah, so Zuron Labs started a couple of years ago and really focused in on trying to really solve the problem of medical mistakes. We do billions of medical imaging exams per year across the globe. And unfortunately, there's mistakes that happen. We think around like 4% of radiology exams have mistakes. So what happens is that you go into a medical clinic and you receive an x-ray. And then the radiologist, I'm a radiologist, I look at the images and tell you, oh, I think that this is what's wrong. And then that report goes back to your original doctor. As part of my experience in being a radiologist, I know that, hey, I make mistakes, and how can we use AI to help make us less imperfect?
Uh-huh. How did you build Xuron?
My business partner, Nick Charnick, him and I both set out to say, what are the technical problems to solve? And so we partnered with some of our initial customers at University of Texas to get everyone energized about this idea of, hey, let's really try to knock down these errors in medical imaging.
You built this on Llama. It's open source.
Right. The language model, open source. And then we basically work with multiple different types of people on the image analysis part. So we built some of our own to kind of show, like, hey, here's how it's done as a proof of concept. And then since that time, we're hosting hackathons to open source models to do different types of detections. And then also working with the commercial AI industry to say, hey, for the benefit of humankind and also to help your own business models, let us use your models for this specific safety purpose. And so the end result is that you as a patient can go in and know there's not just one person looking at my exam. We don't have to do this kind of like YOLO method of doing radiology. We can use AI to help us.
What's the YOLO method?
I guess it's a Gen Z maybe term.
Yeah, no, I know YOLO, but
oh, okay.
I mean, you're scaring the hell out of me that radiologists
use it.
It's a fact of just the way that we do medicine right now is that you have one doctor visit, you talk to one doctor, and then this idea of getting a second opinion is something that you do when there's something really complicated or, oh, you need an additional level of expertise. But we're talking about a minuscule percentage of the population. And if we're talking billions of imaging exams done per year, we're talking a very minuscule amount of exams get seen a second time.
Right. So you kindly showed me how Xuron works before we started. And what took my breath away is that you're really talking about two agents. Will you talk about that?
Sure. So we have two agents. One is a imaging agent, and the imaging agent's job is to look at the entire image and report out, here are the abnormalities that I think are present. So that can be pneumonia, fracture, lung nodule that could become a cancer. It's okay, I think these three things. So it basically votes. These three things are present.
From the picture.
Then we have the language model agent, which is powered by Meta's Llama, that's going through the report and saying, what did the human radiologist think about what they saw in the image? And so we see what the human voted for to say, oh, the human thought that there was a nodule, but they didn't mention the fracture. So then we say, okay, where they disagree, there's something interesting, important to resolve.
So what happens after that?
So then that report and that imaging exam goes back to the radiologist or the radiologist quality team to say, hey, take a look at this, decide what is the right answer for this patient. These sorts of quality and safety committees and organizations exist for hospital systems. They exist at the VA. The VA spends like $100 million a year, I think, on just doing these kind of human level assessments, but they can't hit everyone. And they're usually done months after the fact. With our kind of system, with this AI kind of system, we can do that within the same day to know, hey, there's a problem here. And so it's a much faster, much broader scope because now we can do it for all of humanity, not just a few people or random sampling.
So Cal, I want to ask you, what happens to the information you get? So you've got the scan, you've got the two different AIs. What happens with that information?
Right. So each health system is very concerned about cybersecurity and protection of patient information. So a lot of the initial resistance is, okay, what's happening to the data? From the imaging agent side, it's very easy to run that on the site of the hospital system. So that's great. From a perspective of the text agent or the report agent, that's always been a difficulty about, okay, well, we're going to have to send it out to a third-party service via some sort of interface. But with something like a Llama model that has open weights, we're able to deploy that on the premises of the hospital. So from the hospital's perspective, they're like, okay, is any data leaving my health system or no? That's basically the red line. If we use a non-open source model, then the answer is yes, the data is leaving. If we use an open source model, then the answer is no, the data doesn't have to leave if you don't want it to. And so that's the kind of power. And the second piece of the data processing is that we're talking about, you know, we're talking about people's lives. We're talking about medical mistakes. So we need to be 100% sure about what is this thing going to output. When we feed it a report, we need to have confidence about the sorts of outputs that we're getting. And so having those open weights allows us to have a level of dependability where there's not some kind of silent change that's happening in the background that we can't control. If we have the weights, we have 100% control. And so as soon as the health system says, okay, you have 100% control over everything, yes. And the data stays on my health system, inside of my health system, yes. Okay, we can do that.
How do doctors feel about having AI tell them something that maybe they don't see?
I think doctors at their core level, I mean, we take a Hippocratic oath to do no harm. And so it's just to be seen as, hey, we're here to help. We're not here to come after you. Some doctors are a little bit reticent to know, like, are we helping to train your commercial AI system? Are we helping you to basically become rich and that you're going to take our data and close source this model? So I think once we tell doctors that this imaging model was built maybe by one of your residents, one of your medical trainees, or maybe this was built inside of, you know, your community, you can use it. Like, you can use this system. This model is going to help you on your day-to-day activity. It's not like a 5-10 year type of thing. It's like immediate. Then I think doctors get it and they say, like, I want this. I want this type of system.
How do you scale this business? Is that through hospitals or private insurance companies? Because think how much money they would save, because
right.
Then the patient doesn't have to go back.
Right.
And what about this and what about that, which is what happens in older adults.
In the United States, there's just a really interesting kind of insurance dynamic about who is responsible ultimately for the patient. The ultimate backstop is the federal government, just with safety net type of systems. And then, yeah, then you get into this insurance health system kind of landscape. And I think from that standpoint, we still have work to do as a society to say, what is the value of not making a mistake? Because from an insurance company, what happens is that there's such high turnover because you'll move between different insurance companies. Who is actually invested ultimately in your care? Who ultimately, like, is looking out for you besides yourself? You run into this issue where it's, okay, well, if I don't detect this fracture, it's not going to create a problem until maybe 5 years down the road. Or I'm not going to detect this cancer, so it's going to turn into a problem maybe like in a year or 2 years. Maybe this patient's not on my insurance plan anymore. Maybe this patient's not really in my health system anymore. As a society, we really haven't grappled with that yet. I think the federal government has wised up to that. And since the beginning, there's Medicare rules that say, hey, you have to have a quality and safety program to prevent bad things happening to our citizenry. But it's been a goal without a technology. So there's just been no way to implement it. It was impossible. So it's basically not done, which is really scary. It's done at a very kind of rote, perfunctory type of methodology because it's, hey, this is the only thing that's practical. This is the best that we can do. And so now our job is to go through and be like, actually, we can do a lot more now with the technology tools that we have available that's going to benefit everyone.
What else do you see this tool doing in medicine?
I think ultimately we're going to get to the point where these sorts of technologies can kind of give advice to the radiologist to say, hey, take a look at this area. You may have made a mistake. Maybe it can start to draft portions to say, like, this is the language I would use to describe this particular type of abnormality. So I think that sort of automatic generation of radiology reports can make a huge impact on healthcare spending. We're seeing like 50% efficiency gains just across the health industry from this sort of AI-infused medicine. So even like in your primary care doctor's office, the physician is always just typing on the computer, looking at the monitor, typing everything down. Because of AI and language models, we're able to take those sorts of voice to text and put that into the medical record on its own. So I think those sorts of efficiency gains haven't been seen yet with radiology AI. It's been more about just demonstrating proof of concept. I think this quality and safety thing is a very easy win. But if we're talking about healthcare budgets and what do we do about just enormous healthcare spending, I think that's where we start to see a lot of the gains is when we can start to see AI assisting physicians.
Well, I hope you keep going.
Would love
Cal,
to.
Cal, thank you so much.
Thank
and thanks
you.
For the work you're doing. Appreciate it. We shift to a completely different application of AI, managing and securing your financial documents. Martha Scylla Underwood, CEO of Prism, is helping people ensure that everything from their bank accounts to their critical legal forms are organized and shared safely. Own your own documents, people. We're here at the Seed AI House at South by Southwest, and I just met Martha Scylla Underwood, who has this very interesting company, Prism. You're the CEO and founder. Tell us about it.
Prism is a digital vault that houses all of your financial information, your property and assets, and also documents.
Not crypto.
Not crypto, but we will be aggregating crypto because more and more people have that asset type. Mm-hmm.
But when you say vault, I think crypto.
Yes.
So you're saying this is your overall financial picture.
Well, I wouldn't say overall financial picture. It's a use case to house your overall financial picture, not necessarily to manage it. Because you'll have a wealth advisor or financial advisor that does that. But what the wealth advisor typically misses your everyday accounts. They're looking at your investment accounts, your 401k accounts, and other types of investments, right? But your account that you are buying your groceries out of, that you're paying your childcare out of, they don't necessarily have purview into that. But when an emergency happens or when someone transitions life, those accounts become very important to know where they are. So that's why we call it a vault, from being able to pull in that everyday account information, marry it with your investment information and all your liabilities, your property and assets, and then your documents, lock it all together, and then share it with family and friends where you can control the privacy of who sees what and when.
Nice. Now, but explain, why is that different than a bank now? Because I'm a Truist bank and they're trying to find out everything else I have everywhere else. Is it the same kind of thing?
Yes, it is the same kind of thing. So we will take it a step further, because what the bank does is they'll aggregate all your information to sell you products. But from a document perspective, and actually for a beneficiary perspective, they are not proactive in making sure that that information is up to date. So people get married, people get divorced, you have stepchildren, all these things, but they typically forget, I need to go to the bank to make sure that my beneficiaries have changed. One of the things with Prism that we do is we help you keep that top of mind during your life phase changes, because at end of life, you don't want the person that you divorced 5 or 10 years ago to still be on that beneficiary document and they're getting your assets instead of your new family.
How does AI help?
So AI helps because with so much information, and typically when people are accessing their vault, they need to get to a specific piece of information pretty quickly, right? And so they don't want to have to individually go through my life insurance policy, my will, you know, my health directive. And so how AI helps is we'll sift through all of that information. We'll highlight the important things that you need to be able to communicate quickly within a crisis or whenever you need to communicate something to a bank or anyone else.
So is that your AI? Did you create it, or is it on Llama? What's the AI that you're working out of?
Sure. So we use a combination of AI. So we'll use like the OpenAIs, we'll use the Claudes, we'll use the Llama, so that we can kind of create our own. But we also look at C3, because C3 is a company that...
What's C3?
So C3 AI is a financial aggregator, basically, of AI, or a financial model, I'll say, that is an enterprise model that keeps your data separate, which is critically important, right?
Why?
Because all of the other AIs are public models. And so you want to have a private model. And
so we say
it's safe.
Yeah. And because it changes in real time.
Correct.
Right?
You want to make sure that you kind of keep it separate from what everyone else sees, because you don't want your data leaking out of there.
And you charge what for it?
So it's $99 per year.
Okay.
As a subscriber, and it's pretty easy to use. You log in, it's connect your accounts, connect your people, upload your documents, and then every 6 months, you take a look at it.
And is there an advisor that helps you, or how do you guys do it?
I mean, yeah, thank you for asking that.
Advising?
Yes, it's absolutely advising. So the banks that are on it now have private bankers that advise you on it. Like, here's what you should be uploading. Here's what you should be looking at. Also branch tellers or branch people, because they go in and we couple it with your safety deposit box. In addition to that, financial advisors use it as well as a way to communicate to the next generation. So Gen 2, Gen 3. Because if you're talking to boomer parents, you need to get the Gen Xers involved. You need to get the grandchildren involved to know where things are.
How many people do you have on the platform now, or how many accounts?
So we have several accounts, but we have banks. So the banks basically scale it. So all of their customers kind of get on it from there. But because of the LA fires, we opened it up to the consumers because I don't know if you saw this, but AP had reported that Naomi Osaka, while she was in Australia, had to send someone to get her daughter's birth certificate because she's just like, my house might get impacted. And so it really showed the need for you to be able to have a digital copy of things. We saw a surge of people coming to the site. And so we opened it up and said, okay, if you want to go ahead and get an individual account, you can.
I wonder if any of the states are going to change that you don't have to show the original birth certificate, right? Because if someone passed away, you have to show the birth certificate. But if you're in a fire, just your point, the California fires, what do you do?
Yeah.
You have to wait for it to be sent?
Correct. You have to wait for it to be sent. You got to request it from the county or wherever you live for them to resend you that. And so what we've seen, like during COVID, you had a lot of digital like wills and things being created. And a lot of states adjusted and said, yeah, you can have a digital will. But then a lot of states reverted back to saying, no, we need a wet signature will, right? Because I think that they need to put some policy around it and some thought around it so that they can weed out any bad actors from a digital side.
And do you help people figure any of that out? Or is that information available? Say you're from Pennsylvania. Will you advise people from Pennsylvania, yes, you can use digital or not, or you guys don't get involved?
We don't get involved in that. That is the reason why you talk to your private banker, you talk to your attorney, you talk to your CPA, because you can also invite those roles to your account and have a two-way conversation through documents and through other advising.
And do you have a limit of the amount of people that have access to an account? Like, you know, it's me, but do all my kids and my cousins, or how does that work?
Well, we don't limit it. The only one that we limit is the executor role. We only allow you one executor per account. But because we have a big family, I have a big family. It's seven of us. So as beneficiaries, there are seven beneficiaries listed, but we control who sees what. So my sister and I may see everything, but my other siblings may only get to see maybe one or two things because they're not the ones handling the account.
Mm-hmm. Martha, how'd you get these banks to sign on to this?
Banks are looking for revenue because fee income is drying up.
So you pay them a fee?
The customer pays the bank a fee.
I see.
And the bank pays us from an enterprise perspective.
Martha, you're super smart.
I try to be.
Good. Get money from the bank.
Get money from the banks. Yep. Get money from
the banks. Anytime you can do that, that's a good day.
Yeah. But they need something new, something of value to offer to their customers. Typically, they're charging them for their accounts. They're charging them for statements now, paper statements. And
charging for ACH.
Charging for ACH, charging for checks, charging for everything, right? But it's like, what is the customer getting out of this? And so I think banks are rethinking their customer service while looking at digital transformation, how to make it easy for them. And so if they're thinking of a product of value, Prism was just an easy sell for them because they can cross-sell it when someone comes into the bank to set up a new account. Because everyone wants to make sure that their hard-earned money gets passed on to their heirs and that they haven't worked for nothing all of these years. And so the banks help them understand that, hey, just by making sure these I's are dotted and these T's are crossed, we can do that. And people still trust banks, even though there's a lot of rhetoric out there that they don't. People still trust banks. And so that's why it was an easy sell for the banks. And they're like, why didn't we think of it?
Well, Martha, I'm so glad to meet you. This sounds like an incredible program. And congratulations, and thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
Now we're off to the intersection of music, engineering, and invention with Bosco Cante of High Wave. He's a Grammy Award-winning musician, engineer, and creative entrepreneur, reinventing how we create and share sound. He's found a way to use open source AI tools to make music production more accessible than ever. I'm here with Bosco Cante. He is with High Wave, and I noticed when I walked in, because he had the best booth of everyone, if you can call that a booth. I'm not quite sure. Bosco, it's so good to meet you.
What are you doing here at
the Seed AI house?
I'm telling people about High Wave and Afro AI and about the future of creative social impact technology and ownership and all of the different uses of open source technology and how it enables entrepreneurship for people who haven't had access to capital or access to technology.
Well, that's fair. We got to drill down because I do think that's what's made a difference from last year to this year.
Yes.
With open source, the ability for anyone to, you know, walk in the door and create some sort of companies. Now, the music industry is a tough industry to get into.
Yes,
right?
It is.
So tell me how it's changed that.
So I think that the music industry remains tough to get into, but I think that...
Tough because you got to have talent. And we all think we can sing and
That's
dance.
That's right.
And
That's
by
right.
the way, most of us are not that good.
Most of us aren't. But I meet so many amazing artists. And you meet someone, they can sing, they can dance, they have a vision, but they don't have the capital. And the difference with technology now is that you don't need as much capital. If you go way back, you had to have a huge recording studio. If you go back a little bit, you had to have a desktop computer. Now you go forward, you have to have a mobile device to record. And now you need less and less capital to build not just the music, but the music video, the social campaigns, and you can create full games, you can create applications without having millions of dollars of investment. So it means that the vision of the creator is much more important. So technology is empowering the creators, and open source technology especially allows people to build with less cost, less time, and build things that have never been built before. So it's an exciting time to be a creator.
So give us some examples of on the high wave side of creators. Yeah. That have gone forward.
I'll talk specifically about ElectroSpit, which is a project that we put together. We built this app that can do auto-tune. It can change your voice. And I should just play it for you.
Yeah, come on, play it for me.
You can use Llama in the back end, and you speak into a voice interface. You tell it what settings that you want, and it can change all of the settings automatically. And then you sing into it or you play it, and then it replaces your voice, and you can sound like Peter Frampton, like Roger Troutman, like T-Pain. Like, you can have that electronic but still soulful sound.
So do you think people are more creative because they're not focused on trying to make something work? Because I know when I'm doing my Instagram reels, I shouldn't say this in front of you guys, really. Don't tell anyone I said it. That when I have to spend so much extra time trying to track down something, that then I get lost and it's not as sharp as it could be.
Well, I think that's part of the magic of music and capturing, or like this conversation, you want to capture live. We couldn't go back and say, oh, remember when you were talking about, no, we want to catch it in the moment.
Right.
And I think the more powerful that your tools are, the more likely it is that you can capture that inspiration in the moment. And so that's, yes, part of the power of AI technology. So this is the ElectroSpit app. And when I tap on the microphone icon, create a new preset called Seed AI with the root note of D. Well, so there, it came out Seed AI, root note of D. So now it transposed to that key. And so now when I play,
that's incredible.
Thank you.
That is absolutely incredible.
Creating something like this is so much easier than it has ever been when you combine the AI coding tools, the back-end audio interface that we're doing with Llama, and the mentorship that we provide at AfroAI, our incubator. It just makes the path for an artist to create something like this so much shorter, and so much less capital is required. That means that artists can build something that they can monetize, that they can sell to their fans.
They can sell directly.
They can sell directly to their fans.
Is this the first product that you could say would sell directly, that would be easy to sell directly to, you know, a music audience? I've never seen anything like that. That's what I'm asking.
Yes. Well, I don't know if I can claim it's the first product or not.
I wanted to claim it for you.
Yeah,
I'm trying to help you there.
Yeah, but I don't know of any other.
But I know. The reason I say this, I know some of the kids that grew up with my kids that wanted to be in music, that felt like that bar was so high. They didn't know anyone.
That's right.
They had some talent.
Yes.
But they weren't going to be on American Idol.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
But if you could do this, you're creating music at a higher level.
Absolutely. You can create music at a higher level. You have direct distribution to your fans through social media channels to get access, and you have the direct connection, whether it's through advertising or just direct messaging. They can reach you and purchase, they can download. So yes, you can basically bypass the major distribution systems. Mm-hmm. And instead of having to operate on a scale of having millions of fans, you can have thousands of fans and still have a decent living, build a real business.
Wow. Have you talked to, you know, people at the Grammys or YouTube Music or anything about this? Or do you work with them at all to get the word out?
I think we're kind of in the early days of building this out. We're trying to get the word out. We have some amazing artists that we're helping build different projects, but they haven't, you know, reached the masses yet. But I think that's in our future.
Yeah. I think that's incredible.
Yeah.
How are you going to scale it?
How are we going to scale it?
Do you need investment?
Yes. We definitely need investment. There's incredible projects. Like, I'll mention specifically one called Choice Scores that we're working with, a guy named Kevin Choice. Kev Choice is an incredible keyboardist and MC, and he works with the Oakland Symphony, SF Symphony. And he realized, or we realized, that it took him 40 hours to take a song and prepare the orchestration for the symphony. But that is something that can be done with AI in seconds.
Wow.
But not only does it mean that more of his songs can be transferred and performed by the symphony, there's so many creators that have an audience, but their music is not accessible to be played by symphonies, by school bands, by quartets. So it opens up access to so much music for creators that didn't have that access.
Well, that was going to be my next question.
Yeah.
Isn't this good for schools?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The things that people can build. Like, when I was growing up, I mean, coming through school, we didn't have access to all of this stuff.
Yeah, how did you get into music?
So my whole family is musical. My mom plays French horn. My aunt plays violin. My grandmother played trumpet. At Christmas time, we would all come together and have a little choral band, and my grandfather would sing. So I just grew up surrounded by music and math. My mom was a math teacher. My grandmother was a math professor. I was surrounded by music and engineering, so I never saw a distinction between the two. So I just grew up playing music and being a math nerd. And then I fell in love with hip hop. I won a set of turntables in a breakdancing contest, and became a DJ and started making beats with my friends. And then the rest was history. I did theme song to Living Color when I was in college at USC. And that kind of started off my music career.
Wait, and you have an engineering degree too, right?
Yes, I graduated from USC with a mechanical.
You were the only person in music that has mechanical engineering, you were to say?
Yeah, I think so. And that I don't remember anybody else doing music like I was doing. But it's funny, I graduated with honors. I had an academic scholarship to USC. But because I had the success with the Living Color theme song, I said, okay, I can be a musician, which I didn't realize was possible. But then I did records with Kanye and won a Grammy for the College Dropout, and records with...
Wait, where do you keep your Grammy?
All of that stuff is at my mom's house.
Of course.
Yeah, I gotta
make
sure.
You're a good son.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. So then from there, I started working, did all kinds of stuff. I started playing the talkbox, this instrument called the talkbox. Became one of the top players. Played with David Guetta. I played with Bruno Mars. Played with Snoop. E40, and I decided to reinvent it. So I finally brought in my mechanical engineering degree and made this thing called the ElectroSpit Talkbox. So we did a Kickstarter, we got some investment. Stevie Wonder started using it. He used it on the 50th anniversary theme song of Sesame Street, which was
wow.
Like one of my favorite moments in my whole career, was sitting with Stevie, hearing him play my instrument that I created.
And how is your instrument different than others?
Well, my instrument, I don't think there's any other instrument that does the same thing. It transfers the sound through your throat and out of your mouth. So people who have lost their voice completely, like due to cancer, can use this to sing or to talk. And there's actually a choir called Shout at Cancer that uses this in the UK. So that's been very rewarding. And people who just don't have the confidence in their voice are able to use it. So that makes it different. And it gives me a lot of confidence when I use it on stage.
Oh, I'm so glad you said it, because I thought that was headsets or a way for the sound to come through. But I didn't realize it was that product.
Yes.
And it's cool looking.
Thank you. And
yeah.
I think that's a big difference from the original version of the TalkBox. Is this one has a design and LED, and you can change the colors, and it's stylish. It's much, you know, much cooler. When people see this for the first time, they always have an incredible reaction because they don't expect it. They think, oh, that's a set of headphones or something.
Right.
And then you hear the sound and like, where is that coming from? So, yeah, some of our best content came from catching people when their first reaction, they're like, oh. And I think the tool that you use, it affects the art that you make. And that's the same with the tools that we're creating in Afro AI. These new instruments, these new ways of making music mean that new music is going to be created, and music is created in a different way. So the brush doesn't create the art, but it helps it create different kinds of art and a different way of expression for the artist.
Right. Well, you're incredible. I'm so glad to meet you.
Thank you. Great to meet you, too.
Thank you for sharing this information.
And
we'll put some up on the website. And come to Washington. We're not all geeky.
Yes.
Some of us are cool.
Well, I'm a little geeky, so that's okay.
Oh, yeah. You got that geek side. Yeah, you're right. You're right. I'm forgiven then.
I always say if you're really smart, you're smart enough to know how to be cool.
Ah. Oh, I like that. I like that. I'm going to use that.
All right. Well, thank you for having me on. It's been an honor. My mission is to bring more resources to the community of artists that I work with. So this is a huge step in that direction. So definitely everyone who's listening, take a look at HiWave, HIIIWAV, and our Afro AI program. And we'd love to have you at one of our events, HiWave Fest, and to support our creators.
Thank you so much. It's so great to be with you.
Likewise.
And this is the Washington AI Network from the Seed AI House. Say goodbye with me. Goodbye.
Goodbye. Good.
Thank you for listening to the Washington AI Network podcast. Be sure to subscribe and join the conversation. The Washington AI Network is a bipartisan forum bringing together the top leaders and industry experts to discuss the biggest opportunities and the greatest challenges around AI. The Washington AI Network podcast is produced and recorded by Haddad Media. Thanks for listening.